Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Henry Franz at the controls this morning. Today, fewer and fewer people work in steady long-term positions for one employer. And here's the question we want to try to discuss this morning. Has the dream, the long-held dream here in America of a secure job with full benefits and a decent salary, has that become just that? A dream. This morning in this Focus 580, this hour Focus 580, we'll be talking with Andrew Ross. He is professor and chair of New York University's Department of Social and Cultural Analysis, and he is the author of a recent book that we'll be talking about. The title is Nice Work If You Can Get It, Life and Labor in Precarious Times. It is published by the New York University Press. It takes a look at the new landscape of contingent employment and what that means for workers around the world in both developed and developing nations. Questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Among other things, our guest is interested in labor and work. He has authored a number of books, among them Fast Boat to China, Corporate Flight and the Consequences of Free Trade, Lessons from Shanghai, No Collar, The Humane Workplace and Its Hidden Costs, and a book that we talked about here on this program some years back when it was published, The Celebration Chronicles, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Property Value in Disney's New Town. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And, of course, questions and comments are welcome. The only thing we ask people who are calling in is that they try to keep their questions and comments brief so we can get as many callers in as possible and try and keep moving along through the hour. But, of course, your questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, your questions are welcome. Professor Ross, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Sure.
It seems like the absolute bottom line here of the story that you're telling and the territory that you're exploring here is, as I said very briefly at the beginning, it seems that for just about everyone at all levels of the workforce, almost all levels of the workforce, that job security has really become a thing of the past. And it's something that applies to blue-collar workers and white-collar workers and some of these other groups that you look at, people who are members of the so-called creative class, people who work in communities like the one where I live and the one that you work in. Is that now the reality of work in the world?
Well, it's certainly a question that is on the minds of a lot of people who have lost their jobs in the last year or so. I mean, we're talking about almost 700,000 people every month now. And for many of them, it must seem as if the reason for their loss of their livelihood has a very recent origin, the financial crisis. I think that's a very short-term view of the matter. However, it's not as if, you know, a meteor fell to Earth in the shape of the financial crisis and rendered job security as extinct as the dinosaurs. This has been taking shape for the last couple of decades now as employment has become more and more contingent, more non-standard work arrangements appearing in different sectors. And my book basically is an attempt to explain how that landscape has changed in the last two decades and explain how and why the employment base today has been crumbling so rapidly, because obviously it's many of those kinds of jobs that have been the first to fall into a deep hole. So I would just qualify your question just a little by saying I think it's becoming pretty much the norm in the high growth sectors of the economy, not in all sectors of the economy, certainly not in public sector employment for the most part, but certainly in high growth sectors of the private economy.
Mm. You mentioned, and I think that certainly it's true, that people will look at where we are right now and what's happened recently with the economy and say, well, if there's dislocation and instability, that has to be the reason. And certainly
right,
that's contributed. I suppose, though, then, if you say to people, well, you need to extend your horizon back a little bit more. I suppose the next sort of big stick that people will reach for is globalization, and they'll say, "Well, this is just an example of what happens there with the kind of globalized economy that we have now, and the fact that jobs don't seem to have any roots anymore."
Yeah. It's a fairly, you know, typical, and it's easy to appreciate why it would be an easy reason for people to point to or refer to that globalization as something that's sort of out of people's control, as it were. Again, I think while it's perfectly understandable to say that or to think that, the real reasons are much more local. I mean, they really have to do with decisions that were made by employers beginning two and a half decades ago, that they could cut costs and extract larger profits from outsourcing and subcontracting work. And then we got the rise of the temp in mostly low-wage sectors of the economy. And in the last decade or so, in the 1990s and this decade, we've seen employers expecting to see those kinds of profits in higher wage sectors. So we've seen the temp migrate into high wage sectors of the economy and the march of contingency into high wage sectors of the economy. We heard a lot during the dot-com era about the virtues of being a free agent. The self-implied virtues of being a free agent, liberated from the tedium of some stable slot in a large hierarchical corporation. And then I think in the last several years or so, we've seen a similar kind of promotional pitch being made for the so-called creative class, where largely self-employed talent pool, artists, designers, and wordsmiths of all stripes cities looking for a turnaround strategy, city managers in those locations have been encouraged to court this largely self-employed talent pool. And in many respects, they've become kind of model workers for the new knowledge economy in all sorts of ways. And they're very contingent profiles in work. In fact, in New York City here, the third largest union now in New York City is a freelancers union.
Really?
Yeah. It's an amazing statistic with about 70,000 members. And nationwide, it's about 110,000. And that's sort of been quite mercurial rise in membership in the last few years or so.
Well, you know, this points to an interesting kind of question, and that is it has to do with the rise in the demand or the interest in job satisfaction. And I think that some people would say that one of the things that has changed is that there would have been a time when people, they didn't really expect job satisfaction from their jobs. Maybe they expected stability, they expected a living wage, they expected it to be there, they didn't expect it to make them happy. They didn't expect it to engage their brains particularly. They expected it would engage their bodies. And then when they were off work, then, you know, they did other things to engage other parts. And what's happened is that now more and more people are looking for, we'll put it in quotes, job satisfaction. And that perhaps that they've been persuaded that in exchange, what one has to give up is certainty and stability.
That certainly is an important part of the equation. It's always important to remember this, that there are many people who do this voluntarily, who choose this kind of self-employment that's so pervasive in the creative and knowledge industries. It's proven to be a powerful draw in spite of its disposition for self-exploitation, because these are profiles in work that are notorious for their instability, their uncertainty, people committed to working long, long hours in pursuit of aesthetically pleasing ends and so on and so forth. People choose them because they, despite all of these built-in risks and pitfalls, it does give them a degree of freedom and mobility and control over their time. And also, there is an element of job satisfaction that feels as if it's individually or personally motivated and achieved. And whenever this topic comes up, I always remind people that the demand for flexibility in our work lives really originates in the so-called revolt against work in the 1970s. There was a kind of widespread, systematic revolt against work, both in blue and white-collar workplaces in the early 1970s. And it was perceived as a protest against the tedium and the boredom and the alienation that people felt in organizational employment. And over the last few decades, we associate flexibility more with the managerial initiatives that managers and employers have taken advantage of flexibility to further their own ends. But it's important to remember that the original demand came from workers themselves, and it's still out there, this demand for this appetite, if you like, for self-direction, for more freedom and flexibility and control over one's life and one's economic destiny. And so that's important to remember. There is a voluntary aspect of this.
Let's take a call. We have someone here calling in from a community not far away, Belgium. This is on our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. It is a beautiful spring morning, too. I live through exactly what you're talking about, sir, except that I take a certain exception with you. In the early 70s, we started down a path here, definitely in the Midwest, in the Rust Belt, where we started downsizing a lot of industries and stuff. And in this community over here, where I'm essentially associated with, they've got rid of a lot of jobs, starting in about 74, 75. And this process continued on, and is still continuing on to this day, of job loss. And I think a bunch of the, well, let's take my example, and let's not put anybody else into it. I went into the field that I am in, well, not exactly a field, but the endeavor I'm into, after many times of going into the job market, getting a job, and then being thrown back out again because of economic problems or whatever you want to put a name on it, you get laid off. That's what it comes down to. And I developed my own business to get away from that very condition of somebody saying, okay, today you have a job, tomorrow you don't. Okay? That is probably the biggest problem I've had with being employed in the traditional manner, where being self-employed like I am, there's plenty of work out here if you have some sort of a skill to invest into, and you get all the work you want. There are the downsides that you don't have health insurance, but the rest of it you mentioned there is freedom, and that's the most important aspect of it.
And you feel that your work life is more gratifying than the kind of turbulent or volatile situation you were in before?
Well, the endeavor I was in before would have led me to a lot more money. Okay, I would have had a lot more personal possessions, I'm sure. But I'm completely happy with the personal possessions I've been able to generate with the type of life I've lived.
Yes.
I think is probably something you really have to look at. You have to look within yourself and say, am I going to be happy with what I have? And
yeah.
Say, yes, I'm happy with this. And on top of that, I have an enormous amount of freedom to pursue that happiness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's admirable. And it's for sure there are success stories like yours that people find that satisfaction in those forms of self-employment. Other people are not so lucky, and they're there because they're there involuntarily for the most part. It's the case with a lot of temps and low-wage sectors, and And increasingly, as we see the march of contingency into high-wage sectors and professions, most of the folks who are falling into that kind of radical uncertainty about their future are not doing so voluntarily. In my own profession, the academic profession has seen the most rapid rate of casualization of any profession in the last 15 years or so in the form of adjunct or part-time teaching. And by far the majority of those who work on that basis in the profession do it involuntarily. And their internalized professional ethos about doing a particularly good job and sacrificing most of their lives to do a good job for their students is exploited in that kind of context. So there are probably more people who are in the involuntary situation than there are examples like yourself. And I'm not discounting examples like your own. They're important. But when it comes to numbers, I'd probably put you in the minority.
Well, sir, I didn't go into this voluntarily, I have to admit. I really wanted to stay where I was at. But after realizing that they're just not going to allow me, I said,
Right. Let's
make lemonade, okay?
Right.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Andrew Ross. He's professor and chair of New York University's Department of Social and Cultural Analysis, and he is the author of a number of books, and most recent is Nice Work If You Can Get It, Life and Labor in Precarious Times. And it's about the increasing growth of contingent labor in the work around the world at lots of different levels. It's published by the New York University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Can you talk a little bit more about the so-called creative economy, its growth, and what governments have done to foster that?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of urban policy in this country, several years or so has been very much shaped by this idea that urban managers have to attract the self-employed talent pool, and it's a very cheap urban policy. Rather than spend billions of dollars on public subsidies for sports stadia or tax breaks for fly-by-night corporations, city managers are very easily persuaded that these creative workers are much cheaper to cater to. You build a few bike trails because they love to bike, a few coffee shops, they love coffee, some downtown lofts, they love unorthodox ex-industrial building stock, and also the semblance of an art scene is pretty crucial to the mix. Also, especially for gay people, because as we know, all gay people are born with a creative gene. So they tend to be young, childless, and given to gourmet consumption. But the most important, the most attractive thing to urban managers is that wherever this talent pool settles, they're guaranteed to boost property values. So there is an element of gentrification that is usually attached to their residence, and that is not lost on city managers. The profile of work that they bring with them is also, as I suggested earlier, has made them the new model workers for the knowledge economy. They tend to be very self-disciplined, self-directed. They're primed to win recognition through their enterprising pluck. They're used to feast and famine when it comes to your revenue and income, and they're willing to put in these very long hours. And above all, I think they also, in the creative economy as such, the creative economy is very much organized around blockbuster hits, hitting the jackpot. It's the most casino-like of all of our casino economies because there's the lavish prize of intellectual property that awaits the successful creative worker. And so it very much is that kind of jackpot economy. Some people certainly do hit the jackpot and win the lucrative prizes. But most, you know, subsist either as employers or traditional employees. They subsist in a limbo of uncertainty, juggling their options, massaging their contacts, managing their overcommitted time, and developing coping strategies for handling the uncertainty of never knowing where their next project or source of income is going to come from. And I think some of your listeners will recognize that profile as being very much the mentality of work that's been encouraged in our economy in recent years.
Yeah. There are, you write that there are some places that seem to be making a very quick leap almost from the point of trying to organize a kind of base of manufacturing, an industrial base, almost doing that, but almost leaping over that point to this kind of economy, the creative industries model. And one of the places that you really point to as I think, a good case study is China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of attention in my book to China. I've done a lot of research there, mostly for my previous book, Fast Boat to China. But also the creative industries policymaking is a feature of government activity. In most other countries of the world, there isn't really a creative an official creative industries policy wing in the U.S., although unofficially you can look at all of the subsidies and tax breaks and copyright protection policies that are extended to what we would think of as our creative industries. You know, Hollywood and everything that is such an important part of our export economy. So there is an unofficial policy for creative industries in this country, but it's not called creative industry policymaking, which it is in many other countries. And the modern template was initiated by the first Blair administration in the UK in 1996, and has been emulated by most other countries in the world, and especially fast-developing countries like China and Brazil and India. And I focus on the Chinese example in particular because Chinese government has seen creative industry policymaking as a way of, you know, as you put it, making that quantum leap between a low-wage, low-value-added export platform economy to one that is sort of rich in copyright and intellectual property rewards, one that designs rather than just makes or assembles. So there's been a lot of attention, official attention, from the Chinese government to jump-starting the creative industries in select urban areas of China.
Mm. And that, I'm sure, though, that one of the things that this does is that it fosters this extreme kind of a gulf that you see in China between those sorts of people who live in very rapidly developing and prosperous urban areas, and which is a pretty small slice of the Chinese population, and everybody else, particularly people who live in the hinterlands and in rural areas that that are not doing anywhere near that well.
That's true. It does. It does. It certainly magnifies that polarization and the spread of inequality that's become such a feature of the statistics about Chinese economic life. But it's also in China, the whole idea of creativity is something that the state monitors very closely, because creativity isn't something that can very closely be controlled. It's something that you know, that connotes the free flow of ideas and invention and so on and so forth, which isn't exactly encouraged in most parts of Chinese culture. So the creative industries in China have been encouraged in very particular locations, in industrial parks that are fashioned after the high-tech industrial zones that have become very important to the Chinese economy. And the creative industry parks are fashioned after these. They're pretty high in surveillance because the state keeps a very close watch on what is actually being created and what these creators are actually doing. It poses a threat, in other words, to the state's sense of stability or the monopoly in information and ideas.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another caller here. Someone from Champaign-Urbana here where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Hi, interesting. Could you comment on work contracts? Like, what are the work contracts for citizens of France? It sounds like guest workers aside, a person with a contract has a pretty, you know, long-term job. They have to take training and meet productivity and so on. But it said in the current downturn, they're subsidizing another 100,000 contracts. So, in effect, I guess the government will help meet the payroll for this. And the news said elsewhere in the EU, there's a country with 20 to 30% of the workforce on some kind of unemployment or disability at one time. Okay.
Yeah, well, the EU is an important point of comparison, of course, for the U.S. There are big differences, as we know. One of them I would point out is the fact that the folks who are on non-standard work arrangements in this country, the Bureau of Labor Statistics usually puts the number at a little over 30% on non-traditional or non-standard employment situations. The number's undoubtedly undercounted and doesn't take any account of the informal or underground economy, which is primarily organized on a contingent basis. But in other industrialized countries, the numbers are actually a little higher when it comes to non-standard employment. Certain European countries, and it's an interesting comparison there. One of the differences is that in this country there isn't a big distinction between being in the contingent sector and in many what we think of as standard work arrangements. Because of the doctrine of at-will employment in the U.S., it's much easier for employers to hire and fire. And there are many workers who are in standard employment who don't have benefits, who don't have any long-term security, who are really quite isolated from most forms of social insurance. And so they actually share a lot in common with folks who are in the contingent situation. That's less the case in Europe, where there is much clearer distinction between folks who are in non-standard and standard employment. And so statistically, if you just look at the statistics, it's often not the best point of comparison. What they do have in Europe, however, are industrial policies, which we don't have. We don't have industrial policy in the U.S., which we're really crying out for right now. One of the policies that's become quite popular is this idea of flexicurity, which was pioneered in Holland and Scandinavia, but is now being taken up as a kind of EU mandate as a whole. And it basically is designed to protect workers in flexible labor markets. It deregulates some of the employment rules to benefit employers, but over time it increases the security entitlements of flex workers and strengthens their unemployment provisions. So, overall, the emphasis is on employment security rather than job security in a single workplace. So there's a kind of recognition on the part of these policymakers that job security in a single workplace is not relevant to industrial policy, or increasingly less relevant, and so they should shift the emphasis to employment security as a whole. And this I think, is a policy that's worth looking at, especially if we're to believe the latest Department of Labor estimates are that new learners today will face from 10 to 14 jobs before they're 38, which is quite a sobering prospect.
10 to 14 jobs before 38?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. folks coming out of college.
Our guest in this hour, let me just introduce, we're a little bit past our midpoint, is Andrew Ross. He's professor and chair of New York University's Department of Social and Cultural Analysis. He is, among other things, interested in labor and work. He's authored a number of books, Fast Boat to China, Corporate Flight and the Consequences of Free Trade, Lessons from Shanghai, No Collar, The Humane Workplace and Its Hidden Costs, The Celebration Chronicles, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Property Value in Disney's New Town, and a recent book, it's titled Nice Work If You Can Get It, Life and Labor in Precarious Times. Publisher is the New York University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We've been talking about how the rise in the kind of terms of employment on perhaps on the upper end of the scale where people have no job security and they may not any longer have things like benefits and health insurance and pension. And there are people at the other end of the – they share something there with people at the other end of the employment scale, and in addition, there are folks who work in some of the least desirable jobs in the least desirable conditions who, in addition to not having job security and benefits, maybe are working in toxic workplaces. There seems to be some interest, general interest in what conditions are for these workers. Perhaps we're more interested in the safety of the things they make and we buy, but can you say something about what sort of movement there is that's aimed at trying to make things better for these folks, and does that indeed have meaning for all workers?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've been involved in the anti-sweatshop movement for well over a decade now, and you know, I think we've been able to record some successes, not just in raising public consciousness about substandard work conditions, but also moving sectors of the labor movement in the direction of global organizing, which is now a feature of many of the more forward-looking unions, U.S. unions in particular. The recognition that the global employment on a global scale is something that organized labor has to be taking into account, and that unions have to be doing what multinational employers are doing, which is organizing on a global basis. This anti-sweatshop movement is the second anti-sweatshop movement. The first one at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, was really an effort to establish standards for the national economy. This second round of anti-sweatshop activity is aimed at setting standards for the global economy. In some respects, we've only just begun to do that. The task is much larger, won't be accomplished very soon, but that's the basic goal. Right now, as we're considering all sorts of new ideas, as we're pushing to have labor standards and environmental standards included in global trade agreements, right now is a time is a moment when policymakers should be more receptive to that kind of language and to those kind of ideas. So we're entering this kind of transitional moment for the next several years or so, when neoliberalism, or the economic philosophy that we refer to in shorthand as neoliberalism, is dying. In some respects, intellectually it's dead, but is dominant everywhere in people's minds still. And the next several years or so will be giving birth to a new mentality about the ideas that will guide the global economy. So now is a very important time for keeping in mind the need to drive those standards and conditions upwards. One very good local development in this regard in the U.S. was a recent agreement on the part of both of the wings of the domestic labor movement, an agreement to work together in immigration reform, which is absolutely crucial to raising labor standards and wages and conditions for the entire workforce of the U.S., not just those who are undocumented and operate in the informal economy.
We talked a little a bit at the beginning about the fact that there has been, overall in the workforce, there has been this growth in contingent employment, particularly in certain sectors, and that it's not been, we have not seen it quite so much in the public sector. And yet, I want to get to higher education, this world that that you live in and to some extent that I live in, and certainly we live in here, and about how it is that this area that has certainly been regarded as a very stable employer, at least for a lot of for tenured faculty and maybe for a lot of other people too, is an area where things are rapidly changing, and that we have one place we've certainly seen a rise in contingent employment is at colleges and universities, as we have more and more people who are on annual contracts. We have more and more of the teaching work that's done by graduate students. We have all sorts of adjuncts and people who are not on tenure tracks who are doing an increasing share of the work. And in fact, I think it's the case that a lot of colleges and universities, that's the way that they're managing to control their costs, is by having people like that, because they pay them less, and they pay them less in the way of benefits. But then there are an awful lot of people who from 1 year to the next don't know whether they're going to have a job or not.
Yeah. Yes. As I said earlier, it's been the rise in casualization in higher education has been more rapid than in any other profession. And an additional, at New York University where I teach, 72% of the teaching is now off the tenure track. So what we're really seeing developing is a donut-style economy where you have a very small, a minority of tenured faculty who will give handcrafted attention to the elite core of students, and do research and so on and so forth at research universities. But the mass of the mass of teachers will be on a contingent basis, and that's a trend that we've seen only going in one direction. There are efforts now to try and reverse that, to try and convert some of these part-time jobs back into tenure-track jobs, but they will be very hard. They'll be resisted by university managers in all sorts of ways. The additional wrinkle we've seen in recent years is the expansion overseas by many Anglophone universities, setting up offshore sites, what I call offshore sites, study abroad programs, and in some cases, fully fledged branch campuses in what you might say would be emerging markets in different parts of the world. And I use the term because it is a term that's used by investors in the higher education services marketplace, which is estimated to be in the worth trillions of dollars worldwide. So there are a lot of investors who see these developments in, simply in dollar terms. And there's been a major fight at the WTO in recent years over whether higher education services were to be included in the Global Agreement on Trades and Services, GATS. For the time being, higher education authorities have resisted that push to have higher education included in GATS. But most multinational corporations didn't wait for the WTO to conclude many of its ministerial rounds before they moved offshore. And universities certainly are not waiting for the WTO to move campuses, to set up campuses offshore and move not just routine services and routine labor, but increasingly research. It's much cheaper to do it offshore. And that's a tendency that, although there's a 15, 20-year gap in some cases between how corporations were doing it and how universities are now doing it. It's a similar development in many respects. And that does have an impact on the domestic workforce in all sorts of ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, it does mean that, you know, as I say, it starts off with routine teaching, routine data processing, routine research, but then as university managers find it less expensive to do stuff overseas, they're going to transfer more and more of our operations overseas.
Let us talk with another caller, Effingham, line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Two questions. The first is, the last I read, 6% of the American workforce was unionized. Is that accurate?
Is that accurate?
Yes.
I think the numbers are a little higher than that, even in the private sector. And in the public sector, the numbers are considerably higher.
Would it be 15 or 20?
I think in the private sector is about 9%. Public sector is much higher, certainly about 15%.
Well, then I must have been misinformed. But nevertheless, the historical question, in the U.S., Haymarket Martyrs there in 1905 or 7 along there, and the response to the union activity, and then the organization of the auto workers, which was the piercing element, and then to the 1950s and 60s, and the Teamsters, and the dynamic duo of the Kennedy brothers in sending Jimmy Hoffa to jail and broke the union, more or less. And the only time the unions were strong, if I'm understanding properly, is when World War II was on and they didn't have time to quibble with management. And management didn't want to take the time because of the war effort. And it appears to me, you know, that labor is always on the bottom and the capitalist bourgeoisie are always on the top, and that's when nothing's going to change until that paradigm has changed. So I'll ring off and thanks, Dave.
Well, you may be right about that last perception, but I think another way of putting it would be that organized labor in this country really helped build the middle class. I mean, the famous American middle class during that period of capitalist expansion, the boom period of the post-war period, it was the union wage really that enabled families to think of themselves as middle class rather than working class families that had taken out large debts or large loans that put them in debt. That's been more the case in recent years that the working class families have managed to hold on to their middle-class status in their minds only through debt rather than through real wealth or income, because the average worker's wage has been stagnant for 25 years now. So I think in terms of beginning to share the prosperity that is generated by the national economy, to share it a little more equitably, that will only happen if workers are more free to organize than they have been. There's been a war on labor for the last 25 years or so, and especially in the last 8 years. We had a president in Washington who did not even meet with the leadership of the AFL-CIO. That's never been the case before, but a sitting president who doesn't meet with the leaders of the domestic labor movement is... that's sort of the height of irresponsibility. If you're interested in a co-partnership, an industrial policy, or even a working economy that includes labor and doesn't simply hand over the reins of power to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. So that is why the Employee Free Choice Act, which is legislation that will make it easier for workers to organize, it's probably the most important piece of economic legislation that I've seen in my lifetime, and I'm no spring chicken. It's absolutely critical if Americans are going to see an equitable share of the prosperity in this country for that legislation to pass. So I would certainly urge any listeners to do what they can to impress upon the legislators, local legislators, the need to pass that legislation.
Well, I want to make sure we get at least one more call here. We have someone in Champaign, and this is line one. Hello?
Yes. You're actually quite famous. I was a grad student in Princeton back in the early 90s. And a good friend of mine is a big fan of yours, and I'm in a different field. But I am curious about this Mark Taylor's article recently about the end of the university as we know it. It was. I'm sure you know the article, right? From about a week and a half.
I did read it.
You did read it. I mean, on the one hand, he describes, you know, what we all know is cheap labor with graduate students and so forth. There are a lot of problems, but his answer, of course, was to get rid of tenure. And I just, in my own experience in the academy, I have noticed there's a certain, how should I put it, a certain sort of, you know, postmodern scholar. And certainly I would not include you and many others in this, but Mark Taylor may be one of them, whose interpretation of the academy is interestingly co-opted or allied with the academic administration, in a sense, insofar as they argue for interdisciplinarity. But from the standpoint of the administration, that means, of course, hire one person who knows two or three languages rather than two or three faculty.
Yeah.
Who could, you know what I'm saying? And it's disturbed me for a long time, and I'm curious of your take on that.
Well, there were certain aspects of the article that I agreed with. The response about the abolition of tenure I thought was completely the wrong response. Tenure is much misunderstood in the public imagination in this country. Tenure isn't there for job security per se. Tenure, although it's understood that way as a job for life, tenure is there to guarantee academic freedom. And you know, without academic freedom, we don't have an academy. I mean, we don't have an open society in this country without academic freedom. And tenure is the only guarantee of academic freedom in most higher education workplaces. That said, there are less and less people who have access to the privileges of academic freedom. Academic freedom is a mirage in the desert for most adjunct or part-time teachers.
Yeah.
And so I think we have to acknowledge that, and I'm speaking here as one of the core, I mean the inner core of folks who do have tenure in this profession, we have to acknowledge that security, freedom and security, a balance between freedom and security is important for all employees.
Right.
But that's particularly important for contingent part-time adjunct teachers. We really have to build in certain guarantees of security over time. And adjunct unions, for the most part, have started to do that. We have one of the largest adjunct unions here at NYU.
Oh, really?
They have a pretty good contract, much better than any other institution in the city. And there are all sorts of security entitlements that are built in over time. The AAUP, in addition, I serve on Committee A of the AAUP. We've taken cases in recent years because we wanted to set a precedent. Cases of contingent employees whose rights have been violated, and we're increasingly treating a contingent a teacher as being on probation for the first 6 or 7 years, just as a full-time tenure track employee would be on probation. After that period, then guarantees of security have to kick in on the part of the employer. So I think that level of refinement, there wasn't room for that, I guess, in Taylor's article. There was just this blunt dismissal of the privileges of tenure, which I totally disagreed with.
Right, and thank you very much. I just want to say for your academic activism. I think it's an important example, and I hope that more will follow you. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Just, and we have about a minute left, and this is not much of an opportunity to answer this question, but do you think it is the case that now we'll see more interest among people who in the past wouldn't even have considered the idea of organizing, people and who do different kinds of jobs as we have seen this growth in casual employment, there'll be more people, members of the creative class, people who are academics, those sorts of people, getting more interested in the idea of organizing?
I hope so. I mean, the Employee Free Choice Act will certainly favor that shift in mentality. It will become much easier to get a union recognized, get a contract. But also in the contingent workforce, alternative union-type arrangements are beginning to emerge that aren't tied to single-site employment. And that's one of the more progressive aspects of the labor movement that is worth following, especially for employees who are in that situation.
We will have to leave it at that. If you'd like to read more of our guest's thinking on this subject, you could look for his book, Nice Work If You Can Get It, Life and Labor in Precarious Times, published by the New York University Press. Our guest, Andrew Ross, is professor and chair of New York University's Department of Social and Cultural Analysis. Professor Ross, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.